question is, what did Ham actually do there? And it comes down mostly to attitude. A lack of appropriate respect is our thought. Some linguistic scholars see a similarity with Eden specifically, where nakedness was seen by others was something to be ashamed of. The problem, you see Adam and Eve actually seeing each other naked after the fall for the first time, and they're ashamed and hide. So they point to that same thing. Drunkenness, funny enough, does not seem to be the problem in itself right here. It's not condemned at all. The focus does seem to be on the nakedness, even though it takes place in the privacy of Noah's own tent. And then we move from Ham to his brothers, Shem and Japheth, and we see that they take great pains not to see the nakedness. They walk in backwards, and they provide a covering, just like God provided a covering for Adam and Eve, same word used, that there's a covering. So that's where we kind of go with that. What ends up happening, of course, though, is that Noah curses not Ham, but Ham's grandson, Canaan. And so I point this out because Canaan, of course, is the ultimate enemy of Israel. And so we'll see like the beginning basis of the rivalry between Israel and Canaan right here. It's also kind of consistent with God's promise to punish future generations. You know, we've already seen that God will punish seven times. But this is like, I'm not just going to do it to you, I'm going to do it to your descendants too. So it's kind of interesting that this fits in there. Moving on from Ham and Japheth then, because we have a lot to cover today, we get a long genealogy. This is the genealogy. It basically describes all of the ancient peoples and kind of where they end up. So just a couple of notes about it. There are 70 names in this genealogy altogether. So when Jesus sends out the 70 disciples, or 72 depending on where you read it, he's sending them to the 70 nations. He's sending them to the whole world is the illusion we want to draw from that. You'll see in the lower right, Saudi Arabia. Today you have Shem there. That's the father of the Semites. So when you hear the term Semitic, that's who we're talking about. And you see up in the north, the last green thing before the red block hits, it says Eber. That is the father of the Hebrews. That's the same person there. Rabbinic tradition, of course, is that all of these people are children of Noah and received God's covenant from Noah. Modernly, we have to remember then that there is no slave nor free, male nor female, Jew nor Greek, that we're all children of God. So when we look at it through that lens, this is the basis for it. And then, because that's all there is to say about the genealogies, it's interesting. Moving on to the Tower of Babel. Thematically, this is the close of creation, if you will. After this, the world is arranged as the ancient Hebrews understood it. The name, of course, Babel, we make the pun Babel and Babel, like babbling, talking, like I'm doing now, and Babel. The pun is also present in Hebrew. It's the same thing. Babylonians actually called Babylon Bab Eli or Bab Ilani, depending on which point in time. It means gate of the gods, but the point is that the pun is there in English and in Hebrew. It's kind of funny. We're probably talking about a ziggurat. I've got a picture of one here. Babylon was dominated by one huge ziggurat. It had several other ziggurats too, but this is the kind of building we're probably talking about because it was built on the plain of my autocorrect on my paper changed it. The plain of Shinar. Mine turned it to Shinar instead of Shinar. And that's over by Babylon. That was in the way east over there, over where Babylon would be.
So you're saying that's what you think it looks like?
That's a ziggurat. It could look like that. That's probably more archaeological than it is fantastical. You see the pictures of the tall towers that are round and kind of keep going up. It probably is not like that because the technology to do something like that didn't exist, but something to make a flat leveled, like this is the same general sort of building that the Temple Mound, the temple in Jerusalem ends up being. It doesn't go up as high, but they've got these outer courts and then inner courts. So something maybe more like that, but however you like to imagine it, because we don't know. So. Yeah. have a little thing to build on. I don't know what you mean by that. Well, yeah. Well, this is a seven-level one. The big one was known to be seven levels. So this is a drawing of the supposed to be of the big one in Babylon. Okay. I don't know. Having said that, it's funny that you mentioned it's big because even though the building was a tall tower to the heavens, God still has to come down to see it, if that makes sense. He's, even as high as they've built it, no matter how high that is, the imagery is that God is like, oh, well, I'm going to go down and see what they're doing down there. The sin then is there are a couple of people who think about the sin different ways. One is that man is trying to cross the divide between human and divine again. We've seen that before. Cooperation in and of itself is not considered to be good or evil. Building a tower in itself is not considered to be good or evil. It's the purpose for which it's built. It's interesting then that the punishment is not against a single person, but God changes the language. He doesn't prohibit the building of the structure, but he does scatter the people over the world based on their language divide. This is actually a fulfillment of his promise. After Noah, he said, go forth and multiply again, fill the earth again. And the people are afraid to be scattered. That's part of why they're here building this tower. So it's affecting his divine purpose. In terms of the Hebrews, it explains why there are people spread throughout the world, and it explains why there are different languages. And in terms of application today, we can kind of remember that man cannot thwart God's purposes. We'll see that a couple more times as we're going through things, potentially today or in a couple of weeks. And then unity is not the highest good, but obedience to the word of God is the good. And then monuments such as this are acts of pride and arrogance and rebellion and a mark of insecurity, and again, not good in and of themselves. So let's move over now to Abraham and Abram, because that's supposed to be the focus of the week, and Isaac too. We'll get there. So let's talk about his family real quick. We have Terah. He left Ur of the Chaldees. I just want to show you here kind of where that is. That's down there on the lower right is where Ur is believed to have been. And he moves up to Haran, which is up in the north, up where the Ebers were. You see how that was up there? And then the name of one of his sons is also Haran, the same word. And there's a people up there that are known as the Hurrians, which is, again, the same root word, just different vowels. And they come up with something called the Nuzi tablets. They're discovered at a city called Nuzi in this area. And I'll talk a little bit more about them in just a minute, but I just wanted to show you where that is. Before you come down to Shechem and Bethel and the Negev Desert, et cetera, and Egypt down would be in the lower left. We already talked a second ago about Haran. He died in Ur. He didn't make it up to Haran. He actually died down in Ur. He was the father of Lot and potentially the father of both Milcah and Sarai, who figure prominently in this story. You have Abram, of course. He was married to Sarai. Sarai was possibly also called Iscah. And there's also, from these Nuzi tablets, we find out that possibly Abraham also adopted Sarai, which is a marriage custom that strengthens protections for inheritance and such. So it's interesting when you look at that with Pharaoh and Abimelech in a little bit when Abram says, she's my sister, he may be telling the truth and not lying. So that's just an interesting thought. And then you have Abram's little brother, Nahor, who stayed behind in Ur. He was married to Milcah. And I better leave it off there to because we have to keep moving, don't we? Yeah. Oh, yeah, the call. I better do that real quick. I'll breeze through. All right, so the call to Moah is to leave. He's supposed to leave his country and his people and his family in that order. In return, God promises a blessing. He says, I'll make you into a great nation, which is kind of ironic because we're talking about a tiny family of landless nomadic shepherds at the time. He says, not only am I going to turn you into a great nation, I'm going to bless you individually, and all the world will be blessed through you. Abraham isn't just a recipient of the blessing, he's a channel for the blessing. And that ultimate blessing, through our Christological lens that we like to look through, is that Christ then comes from this line, and all man is blessed through them. So Abram leaves, he follows the will of God. He either goes from Haran or Genesis 12:4 says that he was 75 years old when he came from Haran, but Acts 2:2, Stephen before the Sanhedrin says that God appeared to Abraham before he went to Haran, so that would have been back in Ur. So I don't know when he actually appeared, but there are two biblical bases of it's either in Ur or in Haran. He arrived in Shechem, which is one of the major cities of the Canaanites, who we've just seen were cursed. And God says to him when he gets there, I will give this land to your offspring. Not to you, but to your offspring. This is the idea that the Hebrews got, that the land and the people from that land are inseparable, that this land is the promise to this people, that one goes with the other. He then goes to Bethel, where he builds an altar, and he calls on the name of the Lord. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. And then he goes down to the Negev and then down to Egypt where he encounters Pharaoh. All right.
And we skip lots of different things. Like we're not going to go through like what happens in Egypt. We're not going to talk about Abraham and Lot separating, but we know they do separate. And then we're going to go ahead and jump to, there's three covenants that God makes with Abraham. The first is the one that Jay just mentioned, saying, I will make you a great nation, and you're going to live in Canaan, right? Your descendants are. So the second one occurs in Genesis chapter 15. And in this chapter, God comes to Abraham in a vision, or Abram at this point in a vision. And Abram, I thought this is very ironic, and so did the commentators I looked up, complains to God that he has no offspring. And he knows that God is going to make him into a great nation, but he's like, how are you going to make me into a great nation, God, if I have no children? And so God, the text specifically says that he takes him outside, and God points to the stars, and he says, count them if you can, so shall your offspring be. So I think this is very interesting because it shows like the relationship that God and Abraham have, that Abraham is casually capable of complaining to God, and God is not getting snappy with him at all. And I think that this really harkens over to what Jesus says when he says, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends. And I like the song, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. What a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer. So I thought that was kind of cool. And so he reaffirms the covenant. He says that Abraham will have many offspring and that Abraham's descendants will occupy Canaan. And then in this chapter, we see a super cool ritual that is found in other places in the Bible, like including Jeremiah, but was also a very common covenantal ritual. So God seals this with like a sacrifice. So he tells him to get five animals, all of 3 years old, three years of age. The commentators I saw thought 3 years was a good amount of time because that's when they were like the strongest. And yeah, and it shows that we're supposed to bring God our very best when we sacrifice. What Abraham does is Abraham takes three of the animals and he cuts them in half. And he like lays them and makes like a cute little aisle thing, right? But he doesn't cut the two birds that he has. Traditionally what you would do is, I've seen two ways. I've seen that both parties of the covenant would walk through the rows of animals and say, if I break my promise, may I become like these two animals. Another commentary I saw suggested that only the person of lesser power walks through, which is another way of interpreting it, which I think is really cool. And this is where we get the phrase to cut a deal, right? You cut the animals, and that signifies that you have made the deal. So as tradition, Abraham takes three of the animals and he cuts them in half. We're not really even sure if the two birds that he had, if they get sacrificed or what their purpose is. The text doesn't really indicate too much there. The text indicates that this takes quite a while. So it's possible that Abram was waiting for a few hours. We know that some carrion birds come and try to pick at the animals, and Abraham like shoos them away. And then all we know from there is that a deep sleep comes over Abraham, right, or Abram. It's really cool because in this section, he goes into a deep sleep, and a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch, which are symbols of God's presence. And when we get to Exodus, we'll see like the pillar. lesser powerful person would walk through. That's like that's pretty interesting. But then even both parties passing through is interesting, because the point of this is that you say, whoever, if I break this covenant with you, may I be like these animals, right? And so I think that either way we interpret this, God doesn't ask Abraham to pass through, because God, this points to God's character. It points to that God doesn't give us gifts based on our merit, but based on his loving kindness and his character. And of the three covenants that we see, these first two are the unconditional covenants. God says, I will do this. And then the next covenant that we're going to see is when God does ask for something in return. But this, so God completing this kind of ritual shows that he really means business. This is the equivalent of swearing on your own life. And that's really interesting that God would do the equivalent of swearing on his own life. And this would have been of tremendous value to Abram. It would have shown that God was certainly going to do what he says he is going to do. And I think this has really big implications. We've talked about Mesopotamian culture and the religion surrounding Mesopotamia. And I think that it, when you're Yahweh, right, and you are kind of like creating this new religion around yourself, he has to show that he's different from other gods, because ultimately we know that Yahweh is, there is none like you, there is no other god like you. And so it's a demonstration that Abram, that this God that he has been called to, that has promised him things, is not like any other god that he has ever worshipped. He is the highest God, the most good, the most wonderful. So I think that the way that I view this, this is a really important episode in the revelation of God and who he is and who he is to his people, that does, in its end, show its fullness in Jesus Christ himself. So, yeah.
So it's interesting you mentioned that he doesn't have him pass through as a, you know, I'm keeping the covenant with you regardless of your behavior, because very quickly after this, you see Abram and Sarai kind of distrust God in their, you know, taking of Abram takes Hagar and conceives a child with her, right? On Sarai's, you know, pushing, he said, I can't have a kid. Go have a kid with my, you know, handmaiden. And of course, as soon as she conceives, Sarai is filled with contempt. I'm not sure this was the wisest plan on either of their parts, Abram or Sarai's. But what's interesting about this, and I think is particularly worth noting, because following that, you know, Hagar flees, she's leaving, she's, you know, probably fearful for her life, and an angel of the Lord comes to her. And when you look at what the angel of the Lord says, she says to return. But the angel of the Lord also says, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. Further on, there's the instruction to name the son Ishmael. And there's a portion here that says, his hand it will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And often, I think, in a lot of our contemporary church circles, this is where we get this maybe a negative attitude or language toward people of the Islamic faith or of Islamic tradition or even just that region and area. And certainly you can see within tradition and history there's been a lot of hands being against each other. But what's interesting of this portion is it's not a curse. It's actually an instruction and somewhat of a blessing, because the immediate response from Hagar is, you are a God of seeing. Truly here I have seen him who looks after me. So this is looked at as God taking care of people who, for some reason, have now been grafted into this covenant. You know, there was not going to be a blessing through Hagar or Ishmael if Abram had just, you know, waited and followed upon God. But God, in, you know, seeing that mistake, doesn't then go and curse Hagar and Ishmael for it. He takes care of them. And I think especially through our Christological lens, when we look at this as a God who is constantly taking care of people who don't deserve it for one reason or another, we can see that he's caring for people. It's also interesting that Hagar is an Egyptian, and you can see a lot of parallels between God's people, you know, Abram's people, the Israelites further on, and the Egyptians. That relationship seems to go continuously through Scripture.
speaking of the name that that she uses, that Hagar uses, she says El Roy, or the God who sees. El in Hebrew is like a little g god today, not referring to a specific god. But I just wanted to go over the different names in Genesis that we see. We've already just talked about Elohim and Yahweh early on. Yahweh is a variation of three different Hebrew verbs, all meaning is, but it's like an irregular verb, like in like we have to be is our verb, but we say is and are, and it's kind of like that. So it's a past verb, a present verb, and a future tense verb kind of all mixed into one. And when you're reading along and you suddenly see this and you're like, okay, there's the vav, and so it's a third person, oh no, and it just gets really confused all of a sudden because it doesn't make any sense. That's how it looks in Hebrew. But God is also called then here, we have El Elyon, Melchizedek calls him that, which is God Most High. Melchizedek, just a quick reference because he's mentioned in Hebrews later, is from Salem. Most people think it's probably a short version of Jerusalem, probably. Abraham tithes to him. But Melchizedek puts Abraham's military victory over some of the kings in a theological light. He reminds Abraham that the victory is God's, not his own. We also see God being called El Shaddai. God from the mountains is what that technically means. In 1 Kings 20, the Arameans are at war with Israel, and they think that Yahweh has no power in the valleys and the plains because Yahweh is a mountain god or a hill god. So it's interesting that we see him called El Shaddai here, and then in 1 Kings, that power reference is called here. He's also called El Olam, God the Eternal. El of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Places are named after him too. Bethel, Penuel, Israel, people Ishmael and Israel as well. So it makes me wonder, does God actually have a name? If we have a confused verb that God gives to Moses and says, tell him that the person who is and was and is to be sent you, it's also more of a description instead of a name. So it's the name I'm willing to give you, but it's not necessarily the name. In the ancient world, name was power. You had control over something if it had a name. So I ask, does God actually have a name? And then if God doesn't have a name, we see Abraham and we've seen others as well. What does it mean to call on the name of a nameless God? I just raised that question because it sparked my interest this time around. So let's turn back to the covenants, though, because that's...
So after this episode with Hagar and Ishmael, we go into Genesis 17, which is the third covenant that God makes with Abraham. And this is the first conditional covenant that he makes with him. And this is, so basically it starts with God comes to Abraham, he renames him Abraham, and affirms his original promise, which we know circles around, that he's going to have lots of descendants, and they're going to occupy the land of Canaan. So he also very firmly promises to be their God, not just that I'm going to do these things for you, but you, like, I'm going to be your God, and you will be my people. And so I think that this is, like, this kind of newer concept is why we end up having a covenant, because, you know, I can be your God, but you will be my people. That's something that you have to do, right? So God asks for a sign from the men for this covenant. And it's rooted in the previous covenant, right, to cut a deal. And so the cutting of the foreskin, right, circumcision, is seen as like a symbolic cutting of the animals, and like the sacrificial animals that we saw in the previous episode. So the men of Israel are cutting a deal with God to be his people and for him to be their God. This is also the same chapter where God assures Abraham that Sarah will have a son who inherits the covenant, not Ishmael. And this is where we finally get a specific timeline. So I kind of understand why Abraham and Sarai at the time were freaking out, like, what's going on here? Take Hagar, because it's possible that years would have passed. But now God tells Abram, this time next year you will have a son from Sarah. God also promises Abraham that Ishmael will be a great nation. And I really does not forget about people. He doesn't, just because you're not like the star of the show, it doesn't mean that God isn't going to take care of you. It doesn't mean that God isn't going to provide a life for you. And so in this previous episode with Hagar and Ishmael, we see this phrase like, Bir Lahai Roy, the like well of the living God who sees me. And this is a phrase that comes up several times in Genesis, Bir Lahai Roy, like a well of the living God who sees me. So yeah, I think that's really cool that he sees everyone and he never forgets one. No one ever slips through the cracks. And we'll see this later in Deuteronomy, that these people that God has said that he's going to bless, like Lot and Ishmael, that even hundreds of years later, at the end of the Torah, he has still not forgotten his promises to these people. So I think that's really cool. So yeah, that's the covenant of circumcision. Oh, and then, sorry, the next part's mine too. So we have, after this, we have three visitors come to Abraham's tent's dwelling area. And this is in Genesis 18. And so one of the questions that people often have is one of these three visitors, is one of these people God? John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist Church, indicates that maybe one of them is Jesus, and that this is like an incarnational thing, like where God chooses to occupy like the body of a human so that he can communicate with humans and all of that. But regardless, like Wesley believes that this incarnation situation is very similar to how Jesus would one day walk on the earth. And this is also the episode where Sarah like is listening at the door, and she hears, I just think that's so funny that she's like listening to them, and she overhears that she's going to have a son, and she laughs, and then Sarah and God have this really interesting dialogue about how she's laughing and isn't having faith, and she's like, no, I didn't laugh, God, and God's like, yeah, Sarah, you laughed. Yeah, it's pretty great. And then we are going to skip several things, so timeline, mind thing, we're skipping the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. We're also going to skip the whole Sarah Abimelech saga thing, and we are going to go into the birth of Isaac.
Yeah, so you have the birth of Isaac, and you know, Sarah remembers her laughter. She said, God has made laughter for me, and that's sort of what Isaac's name ended up meaning. And she says, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children, yet I bore him a son in his old age? So, again, it's just, you know, this long saga now that we see is sort of completed of these people going, really, 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 I'm going to have a kid. But where it gets interesting is, and you hit on it a little bit, is this, you know, when she sees the two boys together, Ishmael and Isaac, she says, you know, cast out the slave woman and her son. And this is a displeasing thing to Abraham. This is his son. He doesn't look at him as just the slave woman's son. This is his son. And from a personal standpoint, I often read this and just think about like the consequences of not following God's behavior. This isn't a curse. This isn't God punishing. This is just a natural consequence that now Abraham has to deal with, is a displeasure of doing something, you know, that he doesn't want to do. But God reassures him and says, do not be displeased because of the boy, because of the slave woman. Whatever she tells you, do. For through Isaac shall your offspring be named. Again, he says, this is the line that I'm going to bring, you know, your offspring and bring the blessing. But he also says, and I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring. So, again, it's God going a step beyond, because he didn't have to fulfill that promise of, I'm going to make your, you know, descendants a great nation. But he does it through two different lines. And then they go out into the desert, Hagar and Ishmael do, and there's an interesting portion where she thinks that they're basically out of water and they're going to die, and she says, don't let me watch my son die. And again, an angel of the Lord comes to her and says, you know, hey, this promise has been given to you. God's going to make him into a great nation. And it says, then God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. And there's some different commentaries and questions about, was the well of water there the whole time and she was so disfocused on, you know, she's too focused on herself and her plight to see it, or did God make a well in that area? Again, you know, it says he lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt, and obviously you know the line that continues through there. But I think it's just a different way of looking at it from when I was growing up, where it was, okay, well, you had God promise this, and then they did this bad, evil thing, and that spurred on these terrible consequences that, you know, now have repercussions all the way into today, as to where if you really look at the scriptures, you're looking at, yes, a mistake made, but God choosing to bless people through that mistake anyway and take care of those people, not a punishment that God has created a you know, arch enemy for Israel.
I really, just going back to that, Hagar, was the well already there? I really liked that imagery this time around. It really resonated with me, because how often do we let things just kind of get in the way, and then when we kind of get a step back and we can refocus and look at things a different way, we go, oh, there was God the whole time. I just didn't see it until now. And so I really like that. It reminds me of my own life. All right. But we're going to move on to the Akedah, or the testing of Abraham, right? This passage, it troubles us today. It troubled ancient readers, both Christian and Jew. No one likes God commanding Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. Generally, Jewish tradition has said that the purpose of the story is to show virtue of the virtue of fearing heaven, of fearing God. It also records God's displeasure with human sacrifice. So we have to ask the same question here as we did of the flood. How could God allow this? Jewish tradition has come up with at least one way of saying that maybe this wasn't actually God. Maybe this was Satan, and Abraham only thought it was God. There's I forget if it's a midrash or a teaching in Judaism about that. We have to answer, though, if God is good, right? Then this was not an evil act, whether it was attempted or accomplished, because something that is, if God is good, he cannot do evil. So I have to look at it in that light. And then the sacrifice of an only son is not wrong either, because that's exactly what Jesus was. Jesus was sacrificed, the son was sacrificed. The distinction then maybe is that only God should have to go through this and not man, when we are looking at God's displeasure with human sacrifice, which is recorded throughout the law. Many cultures at the time had child sacrifice. Molech, a Canaanite god, specifically called for it, and they've dug up tons of children's graves, and it was specifically called out in the Bible. It says, don't do this like the Canaanites do it. But Abraham is doing what he thought he was supposed to do for whatever reason, and then God stopped this wrongful sacrifice. The word for sacrifice is for the same as used for a burnt offering. It's a holocaust or a total immolation, something that is completely burned, not just a part of it. We're not talking about like burning the fat portions. It's burn the whole thing. I have to ask, would Isaac have been an acceptable sacrifice? If we look to Cain and Abel, the sacrifice that we saw first, there was one that was unacceptable. And later law says that a sacrifice has to be without blemish. Was Isaac without blemish? This is kind of funny, because Isaac then is the one asking, where's the sheep for this holocaust, for this burning? We know from that Isaac is old enough to talk. We also find out that he's old enough to carry wood. He's also called the only son and the son that Abraham loved, which makes me then wonder about Ishmael, because Abraham had asked for Ishmael to be a part of the blessing. He said, couldn't Ishmael? And God says, no, I'm going to have that be Isaac. Isaac also apparently submits willingly to Abraham and doesn't fight him when Abraham moves to tie him up. So I ask if the question is just as much about Isaac's faith in his father as about Abraham's faith in God. He's taken to Moriah. This name only occurs in 2 Chronicles. It's mentioned there that this is the place of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what it says over in 2 Chronicles. And it takes 3 days to get there. And you know, the question always comes up, why did it take 3 days? Was it because they were moving slowly because Abraham didn't want to do this? Or is it because it takes 3 days to get there? I don't know. What we do see is a reversal of expectations. The story so far has been about the securing of the promise despite Abraham's missteps. He's given away his wife twice. He's left the land. He's gone down to Egypt. It seems to say, again, that human sin cannot end the covenant, that the promise of God will overcome. God can end it if he chooses, it looks like. But really, it's a story about the faithfulness of God and still pursuing that promise. And I ask how Abraham reacted, of course, to all of this. This comes just after the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where Abraham pled for those cities, but there's no peep here that God made, or that Abraham made any request about spare my son. What did it mean that Abraham said he would, when he says to the servants, "We'll be back," did he intend the whole time not to sacrifice? These are just questions that pop into my mind that don't necessarily have answers. And then I want to look at the legacy, and I'll look at Abraham's relationships after this event. The next thing we have is that Sarah dies. And when Abraham comes down the mountain, it says he stays in Beersheba, and we know that Sarah dies in Hebron. That's about 27 miles apart, which is a couple days' journey back in that time. And Abraham goes to mourn her. He's not there. He travels to see her when he dies, or when she dies. So I wonder if they were estranged at this point over this incident. It's something I was looking at this, and we'll look at Isaac in a minute. I just wonder if that's the consequence of this action. Did he consult with her? I don't know. We also see that I have this note about buying the field, because Abraham goes to buy the field to have Sarah buried. And ancient negotiation was a weird thing. To buy land in the first place required an oath of fealty to the one who owned it before. If they were subdividing, they're saying, "I'll give you some of the land, you give me money, and you know, basically, if we go to war, you're going to," you know, it was like feudalism at that point. Abraham, by requesting to buy the cave only, may have been trying to avoid that military obligation. And the price he pays for it, 400 shekels of silver, may have been a sign that this was an inflated price, that he was avoiding it, because we see Jeremiah later, the prophet, only paying 17 shekels of silver for a field. So just maybe it was high. But the way that the negotiation works out, you had to insist on the hospitality of the other. So he says, "I need a place to bury my wife." And the Hittites say, "Oh, just bury her. It's fine. Don't worry about it." He says, no. "Let me buy a field. Let me give you something for it." And I say, okay, the price is 400 shekels, but what's that between us? We don't need to do that. And then Abraham says, "Okay, 400 shekels, that's a good deal. Let's do that." So it's kind of a insisting on the honor of the other person in the bargain, which is a lot different. You see this convoluted negotiation in the contract, and it's a lot different than what we've seen in the covenant so far, speaking to the character of God. That God says, "This is what I'm going to do. Don't worry about your honor. Don't worry about my honor. This is what we're going to do." And you have a clarity of standing with God, and you have a performance despite whatever position they may find themselves in. All right, let's turn to Isaac, too, because there are no other interactions between Abraham and Isaac recorded except when Isaac comes to bury Abraham with Ishmael. We know that Abraham does not want him to go to Ur. He wants his servant to find a wife from their family and sends the servant instead. And then it's interesting when Rebekah comes back with the servant, Isaac takes Rebekah to his mother's tent, not to Abraham's tent, not to the main family, but to wherever Sarah was. So I wonder if the relationship of the sacrifice had become estranged there too because of that. We know that Abraham was a leader of a powerful clan at the end. He was conducting warfare and diplomacy with local rulers, including Pharaoh. He even bargains with God. He has 318 men at his disposal when he rescues Lot. Interestingly enough, there's a relationship potentially between the word Hebrew and the Egyptian word for mercenary, which is Habiru. It's very close to it, the same basic letters. The one time he's called Abram the Hebrew, in fact, he is in the act of war. And so I look at this. We don't hear much more about Isaac at all, but I kind of think of him maybe as a Rockefeller or a Kennedy. It seems that he's kind of been prepared for this public life. His father is a great leader to his people, and his mother is running the business from where she is. And I wonder if he turned away from public life because of this test. And there's a, when we next see him, he's out walking in a field, and I think, I don't know if you'll mention that or not, but the word walk is one that's often used with an idea of meditation, that he's out there meditating in the fields. So I wonder if he turned away from public life to have this relationship of peace and meditation and not wanting the things that his father has been involved in. It's just interesting, the consequences of potentially of this test. So with that, let's turn to Rebecca and Isaac.
So this is kind of like the stuff about Isaac that doesn't really concern his sons, Jacob and Esau. When we were discussing how should we break up the patriarchs, it became clear that Isaac was going to kind of be the add-on of Abraham, which is kind of sad. And I wonder, like what Jay is talking about, like his kind of possible retreat from public life, if that contributed to him just kind of being like a, oh yeah, and there was the middle patriarch. Regardless, though, of Abraham and Isaac's relationship post almost sacrifice, we still know that Abraham takes very seriously this promise to God that a great nation will come from him. And so it's very important to Abraham that this woman that marries Isaac comes from his own family. So he takes a servant, and he makes this servant swear to find a wife from his own family. And it does. It shows that Abraham very much takes this very seriously. It also, I think, becomes important, like when next week when we talk about Jacob and Esau, that they can't take foreign women and bring them into this covenant to be their wives. And we see this with Jacob being sent away to go find wives compared to Esau, who takes Hittite women. We'll talk more about this next week, but Esau taking two Hittite women to be his wives would be a huge slap in the face to this monotheistic family. Back to the servant. So Abraham takes the servant, and he has him place, place his hand under his thigh. And I remember reading this thinking, this is really weird. And if studying the Pentateuch has taught me anything, if you see something weird, stop what you're doing and Google it. And so I looked this up. I was like, why do you, like, Mitchell, can I make a promise to you and stick my hand under your thigh? Like, no, that's weird. And so there's two lines of thought on this. One is more academic and kind of weird. So one idea is that under the thigh is a euphemism for under the genital region. And this makes a lot of sense, actually, because, you know, Hebrew men, like, they have the circumcision, right? And this is a sign of their covenant to God. So this would be like they are swearing on their covenant to God. Like, I am going to do this, kind of similar to swearing on your own life. The more rabbinical viewpoint, which is a little more kosher, if you will. I couldn't resist the kosher pun. Anyway, is that that by placing your hand, Rennell's laughing at me back there, by placing your hand under someone's thigh, you are submitting to their authority. So this being that the servant is submitting to the authority of Abraham and saying, you have authority over me, and whatever you tell me to do, I will do. So very important to Abraham that the servant does what he says. So the servant goes to the house of Laban, and Laban will pop back up again next week, because Laban is the, wait, I have it right here. He is the brother, right?
He's related to Sarah. He's the brother's son.
Yeah.
So nephew.
Yes. So this is the cousin to Sarah, but then also the father of Leah and Rachel. So he goes to Laban, and he sees Rebecca before he actually meets Laban. And they have this cool little exchange about needing water, and Rebecca's a really nice lady, and she's also wearing all this cool jewelry and stuff. And so they end up going to Laban, and the servant's like, hey, got a master, it's pretty great, needs a wife, she's cool. And so Laban, the text specifically says this, and I think this is so interesting, especially in a book that so far only sometimes names women. And if they name women, it only commentates on their ability to bear children. So it says, Sarah, she's beautiful, she's also barren, right? And then also we see Noah. Noah's wife doesn't even get a name. So we don't really have very much honoring of women so far. But it specifically says that Rebecca think of this? Would you like to go marry this supposedly really cool dude? And Rebecca totally consents. She's like, yeah, let's go. Let's go do this thing. So she goes, and Isaac, this is when Isaac is walking in the field meditating, and she's like, who's that guy over there? And they're like, oh, this is Isaac. So she veils herself, right? And then it says that they get married or whatever, and it says specifically that Isaac loves her. And I just thought that was so sweet. Isaac loved his wife. It doesn't really say particularly that any of the other patriarchs loved their wives. You know, it says that Sarah is beautiful, but that doesn't mean that Abraham really loved her, right? It does say that Jacob loves Rachel. Yeah, Isaac specifically loves her. I also want to point out, Isaac is the only patriarch that doesn't take more than one wife. And this seems to work out really well for him. All the other patriarchs that take more than one wife, it causes a lot of trouble. So this is why you only marry one person, guys. So I just think it's really cool. Her opinion is asked. Her husband loves her. And she doesn't have to share him with anyone. And I think that there's a lot of fruit being born from honoring Rebecca, even though she does cause quite a bit of trouble, which we'll talk about next time.
Let me jump in just with one last thing, because you're harping on this. She was asked. And I talked about the Nuzi tablets earlier from this area up by the Hurrians. That's part of their custom. If the brother writes the marriage contract, he has to ask the sister. That was one of the protections that was written into their law. So I have this under why Abram, right? We see that Abraham consistently is acting with the under this custom. He's looking for adoption. He has his servant Eliezer before he has sons. He's adopting him so that he can inherit. That's part of this Nuzi custom. He potentially maybe lies to Pharaoh and Abimelech, but maybe he tells them the truth because he may have adopted her. That's consistent with Nuzi tradition. Also having these household gods that we'll see with Jacob later is part of this Nuzi tradition. We see other things too that are consistent with it. But let's talk about his character for a minute. What do we actually know about him? Why would God choose him? We can't answer that, obviously. We know that he abided by custom. He lied to Pharaoh and Abimelech for self-preservation, most likely. Has a lack of faith that God will protect and provide based on that lie. He puts Sarah into a terribly vulnerable position by basically prostituting her out once, because the second time specifically says that didn't happen, but potentially, you know, twice that he could have put her in a bad spot. He was the senior in terms of Lot as his nephew, so when he comes out of Egypt and their flocks are too big, he says to Lot, why don't you choose your land? Even though Abraham had the right to choose, he lets Lot choose where he is. We know that he consistently offers sacrifices. He refuses to take the charity of the king of Sodom. And when we see what happens with Sodom and Gomorrah, maybe there's a reason for that. But there's no statement about Abraham like there is of Noah, that he was righteous, blameless, or walked with God. He does seem to take securing the promise into his own hands. He buys Sarah's plot. He hasn't been given any land, so he buys land. And then we have this statement that it was credited to him as righteousness. And the Hebrew is very interesting here because the way it's written, either God or Abraham can be both the subject and the object. So if we say that, we could say that God valued Abraham's trust and rewarded Abraham for it. That's the way that we usually interpret it. But we could also say that Abraham trusted God's word, and it's more evidence of God's faithfulness and righteousness rather than man's righteousness. So it's just an interesting thing that we don't know why he's chosen, just that God is righteous and that the promise and blessing will come through it. And with that, next time we'll pick up with Jacob and Esau and the rest of Isaac, and then go on to Joshua, and then we'll be done with Genesis. I did it again. Joseph. We'll do Joseph, not Joshua. We're going to skip ahead 6 books and call it part of the Pentateuch. Yeah. I did that all week. Have a great week, everyone.